Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Old Theatre, where it's a great pleasure for me to be able to introduce one of our most distinguished alumni, George Soros. I was about to say one of our most notorious alumni, but no, I think that wouldn't be right. I think distinguished I will stick with. We have had, over the last few weeks, in last term and this term, a number of people in the school speaking about American foreign policy, and indeed there are a number of books written about how we should think about the Bush approach to foreign policy. We had Larry Summers here a few weeks ago with a somewhat optimistic reading. His analysis, for those of you who were here, was that US power was at its zenith, but US influence was at its nadir, and that no US administration should be comfortable with that position, and therefore, over time, we could expect a US administration to be looking to strengthen the transatlantic relationship and to strengthen its relationship with other countries through the global fora of which it's a member. Those of you who've read Paul Krugman's latest book will see a rather different interpretation of the Bush foreign policy, where he describes the Bush regime as a power analogous to revolutionary France, with Bush in the slightly implausible role of Robespierre, and sees the US administration as one which positively relishes its position outside the global consensus and thinks that is the best way for us to understand US foreign policy. Today we will hear a third interpretation of the Bush regime. George Soros, in his book, talks about a kind of foreign policy based on a Darwinist view of the world, but I will not do what sometimes tiresome introducers do, which is to use their own words to paraphrase what the speaker is about to say. So I'll stop at that point and invite George to speak to us. He will talk about the thesis in his latest book. Mary Caldor will then offer some thoughts in response, and then we will throw it open to comments and questions from the floor. So with great pleasure, George, that I introduce you, and welcome to the school, welcome back to the school, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you.
Well, in a way, the title says it all, The Bubble of American Supremacy. My contention is that the U.S. government has fallen into the hands of a group of ideologues who have adopted, or they had this ideology before they became part of the government, of American supremacy. And after September 11, they gained the upper hand and have been very influential in shaping that policy. There has now been a little bit of a change lately under the influence of the forthcoming elections. There has been a little bit of a deflation of that bubble of American supremacy. You might have seen Cheney came to Davos and talked about international cooperation, and the United States has turned to the United Nations for help in settling the political future of Iraq. Nevertheless, I think that America has gone off the rails after September 11. And I think it's very important to puncture that bubble, not enough to deflate it. Because if you just simply deflate it, it actually might expand again after the elections. Now, the ideology of American supremacy is based on the belief that international relations are relations of power, not law. And international law basically ratifies what a power has accomplished. And since America is so powerful, it ought to use that power and impose its will on the world. Behind this belief is an ideology which I call sort of a crude form of social Darwinism, that the survival of life is a struggle for survival, and that struggle, the outcome of the struggle, is determined by competition, not cooperation. Whereas in actual fact, in order to survive, we need to cooperate. And in fact, so this is why it is a crude and distorted form. It has found expression in the Bush Doctrine, the national security, new national security doctrine, which is built on two pillars. The first pillar is that the United States must maintain its unquestioned military superiority globally and in any region of the world. And the second pillar is that the United States has the right for preemptive action. Now, each of these propositions on their own have some merit. I mean, I think it's very desirable that America should be strong, and there are conditions where preemptive action is justified. But if you put it together, you get two classes of sovereignty. The sovereignty of the United States, which is sacrosanct and not constrained by any international treaties or obligations, and the sovereignty of the rest of the world, which is subject to the Bush Doctrine. And that is, of course, to me, very reminiscent of Orwell's Animal Farm, where all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Now, I consider this doctrine profoundly un-American and also unacceptable, can't possibly be accepted by the rest of the world. It's un-American not only because of this inequality because that actually can be very popular in a country which is in fact very powerful. But it's un-American because it suppresses criticism. Because the president has wrapped himself in the flag, and after September 11, for about 18 months, he could not be criticized without appearing to be unpatriotic. And because of this lack of critical examination, which is at the very heart of an open society, the policy has been used in a way which is counterproductive and also misleading. The first practical test of the Bush Doctrine was in Iraq. And the world, generally speaking, had an allergic reaction to it. Not because anybody has a good word to say about Saddam, but because it was practical use of this doctrine of a preemptive action. Now, my book has two parts. The first part is a critique of the Bush Doctrine and American foreign policy. The second part is an expose of a more constructive vision of America's role in the world. And I don't really want to dwell on the first part. I should say that my goal, based on this analysis, is to use the 2004 presidential election as a referendum on the Bush Doctrine, because President Bush did not come into office with that doctrine. He came on the platform of a humble American foreign policy. It's true that as soon as he was in power, he then rejected the Kyoto Treaty and so on, and generally showed a dislike for international treaties and international institutions. But it's only after September 11 that the groundwork for the Bush doctrine was built. So if we now reject him, then we can write it off as a temporary aberration due to the traumatic experience of September 11. If we endorse him, then we are endorsing the Bush Doctrine, and we will have to live with the consequences. But you don't have a vote in America, and therefore I don't particularly need to elaborate this issue. I will elaborate it in the United States. What I'd like to do more if in a few minutes, just to sketch a different vision of America's role. Because it's remarkable that basically the United States is the dominant power in the world. It sets the agenda. The rest of the world has to respond to the agenda that the United States sets. But only people in America have a vote. And therefore, there is a special obligation for the United States to take into account the global system, what happens in the rest of the world, because it is the United States that sets that agenda. So we have to be concerned about the global arrangements that prevail. All forms of cooperation, not all, but most of them, require American leadership or American participation. Now, we now live in a globalized world with global markets, great high level of interdependence. But the political arrangements are built on the sovereignty of states. And there is a problem here, because what happens inside countries is of great consequence for the world. But the principle of sovereignty militates against intervening in the internal affairs of sovereign states. The sovereignty also makes the functioning of international organizations more difficult, because organizations like the United Nations are associations of states, and states have interests and no principles, and generally pursue their national interest in preference to the common interests of the world. So that interferes with the functioning of the international organizations. But the real difficulty is how to intervene in internal affairs of other countries. Now, there is a simple solution that can take us a very long way, because if you offer incentives and facilitate and reinforce those countries that are moving towards democracy and let's say open society, you can take the Copenhagen criteria that are laid down for the European Union as sort of a desirable goal. If you have arrangements that reinforce them, that doesn't interfere with the sovereignty of states. In other words, if you extend a helping hand, provide incentives, there is not enough of that in the present arrangements. There are not enough carrots, so to speak. So I'm advocating creating more carrots, which also gives you new tools for punitive action, because by withdrawing carrots, you can exert a lot of pressure on countries that are in some ways failing the standards. And you don't need to go into sanctions, which tend to hurt the people rather than the rulers. And in fact, sanctions are very often counterproductive because they actually reinforce the regimes that they are meant to punish. And of course, you have less need for military intervention. But that doesn't deal with the issue of what do you do about countries whose rulers are actually oppressing the people and have no interest in meeting, in being democratic or free. What do you do about the likes of Saddam? That is the great unsolved problem of our global system. Now, I have a long argument and a number of suggestions. I don't think I have time to go into it because I'd like to get into a question and answer. So maybe I'll actually stop here. And there are several suggestions, like the concept of the people's sovereignty, the suggestion of a community of democracies, and so on. But I'll go into it in the question time.
Thank you. Now, Mary Calder, who needs little introduction in this community, will respond.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great privilege to be on a platform with George Soros, who has consistently offered a voice of reason and integrity on the big issues of our time. And I have to say that I've been following his lead on the big issues going right back to the 80s when we were trying to make changes in Eastern Europe. And I think it's of great importance that he is now addressing the issue of open society in the United States itself. As always, I tend to agree with almost everything he says, but I want to add a couple of amplifications or comments, one relating to the United States and one which I simply can't resist since today is the day after the Hutton Report, something related, and I've cleared it beforehand with George, something relating to our own situation here in Britain. First, on the United States, I mean, my feeling is that this phenomenon he describes, this combination of market and religious fundamentalism, goes much further, and this is what I find so worrying, than just the small group who has hijacked power in the current American administration. My fear is that it has reached deeply into American society and culture through the media, through the educational system, through the churches. George, in his book, mentions the importance of nostalgia for the Cold War. My own analysis would suggest that the kind of structures that were built up during the Cold War, the defense industries, the armed forces, the laboratories, the bureaucrats, the think tanks, represented, I would argue, a kind of closed society, or if you like, a little bit of totalitarianism within broader American society. And I think it's had a very corrosive influence. It was Eisenhower, of course, who warned of the influence of the military-industrial complex when he left power in 1957. And I think what happened after the end of the Cold War was that America never had its perestroika. Military spending did fall, but not anything like to the same degree as it fell in Europe, for example, and especially in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. And in fact, things like military R&D remained at roughly the same level, research and development, where the future is being developed. And I think one of the real problems is that there was a huge, if you like, vested interest, as well as an intellectual interest, in the continuation of an idea of America that was locked in a grand struggle over a long time. George describes very well the way Bush's preemptive strategy produces an escalatory response. It produces more terrorism that then allows you to justify your next preemption. And I think in a way that's how they think. Not that they want a terrorist response, but certainly Rumsfeld said that the war on terrorism would last another 50 years. It provides a framework for something on the Cold War model for a long time to come. And I think that if we're going to address this, we need to address it in a way that goes deep into society and rather the way the Open Society Foundations tried to address the situation in Eastern Europe in the 80s and early 90s. So that's my first point. My second point is my real fear that we in Britain have somehow been sucked into this phenomenon, that by supporting Bush, we've ended up by being manipulated in the service of this phenomenon. Many of us have become increasingly concerned about the centralization of government around the position of the Prime Minister, about the growing importance, or maybe it was always there, of patronage, about the loss, if you like, of the separation of powers. But I think I want to say something about why I think the Hutton Report is really not done a service to our democracy. I think we've gone through a process which has been open and independent. We've had lots and lots of information available to the public. I have no doubt that Lord Hutton was independent. But at the same time, the whole process was set up in such a way that it has merely served to legitimise the government and government positions. And I'd like to mention two points in relation to this. One was, of course, the narrow way that the terms of reference were set. The issue that Hutton was addressing was not whether the government exaggerated intelligence or why the intelligence was wrong in the lead-up to the war. The issue was an inquiry into the death of Dr. Kelly. And my feeling is that this was Alistair Campbell's last and most brilliant piece of spin. He seized on what was a very sloppy piece of journalism by the BBC. It was a sloppy piece of journalism, but nevertheless, it was only broadcast at 6 o'clock in the morning. And he knew that this was a sloppy piece of journalism, so he seized it and totally diverted attention from what was the real issue. And he seized it knowing that on this particular issue of the sloppy piece of journalism and the handling of David Kelly, the government was likely to be vindicated. And I think probably it's difficult to censure the government for its handling of Dr. Kelly. They couldn't possibly have known that he would commit suicide. Although I do think the Ministry of Defence in particular has got off very lightly. But I think the bigger point is that it has to be put in a broader context. So that's one point. The second point is that the judge in this inquiry was appointed by the government and was presumably very carefully chosen. He was a conservative judge who chose first to interpret his remit extremely narrowly. He could have interpreted it more broadly. And secondly, he, as Andrew Marr, I don't know if any of you saw him on the television last night, said, he chose to believe more in the words of politicians and officials than in the words of journalists. And I think the real point to make here is that this is a matter. He's making a judgment on the basis of evidence, and the evidence is available for all of us to make judgments too. It is normal in cases of this kind to appoint more than one judge. It's rather unusual to appoint just one judge. It's normal to appoint two or three judges so they can debate the evidence and debate different positions among themselves. And so what I think this has led to is something that actually is not in, I don't think in the long term is going to help the government, because it feels like a whitewash. It won't draw a line over the issue. I think it has left people feeling that they have been manipulated. And it's left people feeling that dominant opinion in this country is not really being politically represented. And that kind of feeling can lead to alienation. I think we already see that kind of alienation in the Muslim community. There are a lot of questions that remain, just to give you a few examples, and remain out of the Hutton evidence. In the September dossier, for example, why does it not say that the 45-minute claim only referred to battlefield women, weapons? Even Hutton asked that question, because it was represented in the press as an international threat, whereas the battlefield weapons could only be used inside Iraq. How did intelligence get to be so wrong when it was contrary to the views of the expert CBW community in this country? Most of them said, and Robin Cook quoted those opinions in his resignation speech, that they believed that he possibly had some battlefield chemical and biological weapons, and he probably had programs, but not weapons of mass destruction that could hit international other countries. And why was the Director of Communications allowed to chair important intelligence committees? Now, I could go on asking more and more questions. You all know what the questions are, but I think if we want to preserve an open society in this country, I think there are two things which are very important to say. One is that there has to be a public inquiry with several judges into why we went to war with Iraq and why the intelligence was so misleading. And secondly, I think it's terribly important to defend the BBC. I think the BBC is a wonderful example of a public service television that is admired all over the world and is probably our most important influence on the rest of the world. It is a very high quality public service, and it would be terrible if these criticisms led it to narrow its judgment of what it can do and how it can act. Well, let me finally say, let me come back to George's book and say, I think this idea of preemptive democracy is a really important idea. I do think there is an onus on us who opposed the war to say how we are going to deal with people like Saddam Hussein in the future. I don't think it's enough to say don't go to war. We really do have to offer an alternative, not only for dealing with tyrants like Saddam Hussein, but also for dealing with the problem of global terrorism. And I think there are a lot of ideas in the book that do offer such an alternative. I suppose what I really wanted to say is that I think if we want to persuade our governments to adopt such a strategy, then we have to do some work within our own societies. We have to prevent open societies from being undermined, from being hijacked in this current situation. We talk about bringing democracy to other countries. I think one of the most heartening things that's happened in the last few weeks is day after day after day, non-violent, peaceful demonstrations in Iraq calling for elections. I mean, that is very, very heartening, actually. And we could take heart from that and use some of the energies that we have to try to preserve open societies in Britain and in the United States. Thanks.
You can take the man out of the regulator, but not the regulator out of the man. And as a former regulator, I have to say that I don't want to be accused of mis-selling, and I really have to point out that you won't find the word Hutton in George's book.
George said it was all right.
You do find two or three references to Blair, but far more to Karl Popper, actually, which is an interesting and important comment, I think, on what the book's about. Let's take some questions and comments, and I would encourage you, one, to wait for the microphone, because you may think you have a strong voice, but you can't be heard terribly much in the cheap seats at the top if you speak. So, and say name and where you are. Thank you. First one, just there.
Hi, I'm Teddy from the Development Studies Institute here. You've recently come on record saying that you'd stake your personal fortune and taking out George Bush. I have a two-part question, really. So, can you give us a ballpark figure, just how much you're willing to pour into whatever Democrat campaign it is? And relatedly, how much of your personal fortune might you be willing to put towards my tuition fees?
Well, I spend annually about $450 million on the foundation network. And so far, I have committed $12.5 million for political activities in the United States. I think it's a very good ratio, and I would like to keep it there. But if the need arises, because there is such a disparity between the amounts available of pro-Bush as opposed to contra-Bush, I am ready to step in.
Richard Laird.
Richard Laird. Is there any way American supremacy can be brought under control unless Europe gets its act together? Do you think there is really any force which will change the situation other than a common foreign policy and defence policy in Europe? And if so, how are you going to bring that about? How many of your dollars?
Actually, I don't think that there are too many external constraints on America's pursuit or dominance, because America, it's a reality that America is the dominant power, and it is in the national interest of most other states to ally themselves with America, as demonstrated by Britain and a number of other countries. So I don't see anywhere in the near future, let's say, a coalition of states emerging that would in any way rival America. So it has to be self-constrained on the part of the United States, a recognition that the policies we are currently following are counterproductive, that this is not what made America as dominant and as great as it is currently, that can change the situation. Now, at the same time, I think Europeans who have a different vision of how the world ought to work indulge in criticism of America as an excuse for not doing what they ought to be doing. I mean, when it comes to international cooperation, the World Trade Organization talks broke down. And it's basically Europe that stands in the way of opening agricultural trade, which is the next major item on the agenda. So I think the European Union and Europeans generally could do a lot more to show how cooperation could work. And in that context, I'd like to mention an initiative coming out of the European Commission for a wider Europe. It's, I don't think any of you have even heard of it. It's currently in the making. And I think it's one of the few really constructive suggestions that come out of the Commission, learning from the mistakes of the past of how we handled, or how you handled the Balkans, and so on, because it gets away from membership, because in the, probably there is not much room for further expansion in the near future beyond the people, beyond the countries that are currently under consideration. Yet there is a group of countries that do need actual assistance and help from the European Union to become more democratic and more prosperous. So it has to be an asymmetric relationship. The EU has to actually extend concessions on trade without countervailing concessions on the other side, and also assistance. And that is what this wider Europe initiative envisages. And that also would then require, it would offering carrots, it could require those countries actually to meet certain standards. And if they don't meet those standards, withdraw the carrots. That is a very powerful form of influencing development in the wider Europe, which happens to cover the same territory as Russia's near abroad. So you have a certain competition in that area, and it's very important that there should be, because otherwise the Russian Empire will be reconstituted in short order.
A number of people have caught my eye. Next one, right up there.
Jan Krzywinski, second year undergraduate international relations student. Do you really believe that a change in the U.S. administration will lead to a change in the fundamental assumptions of U.S. foreign policy? Thank you.
I do believe so, but I don't think it's enough to get rid of Bush. You really do need to develop an alternative vision. And that is sort of the second part of my book, and that's the one I'd really like to generate a discussion about, also in the United States, because this vision, this alternative vision, is not currently developed or widely accepted.
Next one there.
Thanks. Just a quick question. Ian Ellis, Information Systems. I just want to find out a sort of a two-part question. Do you see a role for the United Nations? And if you do, do you see need for change maybe in the structure of the General Council and then also of the Security Council?
Definitely you need the United Nations. But people don't realize the constraints. Namely, it's an association of sovereign states and they have their national interests. And that makes it very difficult to reform, because no country is going to abandon its privileges. I don't see France, let's say, abandoning the veto right in the Security Council. So all efforts at significant reform have failed and are liable to continue failing on that point. Now, in the book, I propose establishing a community of democracies. There is a Warsaw Declaration which was signed by 140 odd countries, more democracies than there are in reality, which proclaims that promoting democracy in other countries is in the interest of all democracies. So building on that principle, I'd like to see. And this could be done. This community of democracies could function within the United Nations and outside the United Nations. So this could give you that coalition of the willing that could give you a legitimacy for intervention, even outside the United Nations. But within the United Nations, if you, let's say, replaced the group of 77, which is now a, you know, the non-aligned nations, non-aligned with whom? They are, it's an anachronistic association. You replace that with a group of developing democracies led by countries like Brazil, Mexico, South Africa, Nigeria, India, Indonesia, Korea, and then, of course, a number of other countries. And that bloc would cooperate with European countries, with the United States, or Australia, and the others. You would actually have a majority in the United Nations. And these blocs could continue to differ from each other on a number of issues, but they would agree, let's say, on one point, that only members, that is to say democratic countries, countries that qualify as democratic, would be elected to the Security Council and to the various commissions. As a result, you wouldn't have Syria on the Security Council, you wouldn't have Libya as the chairman of the Human Rights Commission. And that is a reform that could be done without hurting the charter. This is doable, and I think it would make the UN function better.
Oh, question over here.
Tanya Gold from the Daily Mail. I wanted to ask you if you were financing any political activities in Britain, and more specifically whether you're going to fund or you're thinking of funding the British Conservative Party.
The answer is no.
In the third row, sorry, can we have the microphone back down the front? Is that not working?
Jane Taylor, Positive News. I'd like to know more about your ideas of people's sovereignty, and are you about people's sovereignty that you mentioned? Were you perhaps in favour of a People's Assembly attached to the UN, which there are various thoughts? George Monbiot is talking about a world parliament. What do you think about that? What do you think about the World Social Forum that a lot of us have been following quite closely? And I've been involved in a proposal for a World Future Council, which would be a kind of council of elders, because we don't quite see how, not it can be youth as well, of course, but it would be to take a direction that we all agree upon, because the world keeps going in directions that nobody really wants it to go.
What was the very first question? Was the very beginning of it? People's sovereignty of people. Yes, I mean, sovereignty is an anachronistic concept. You know, it's kings and subjects, and the kings can do with their subjects what they like, and it's an outmoded concept. But it was brought into modernity in the French Revolution when the king was beheaded, and people took over sovereignty. That was the foundation of the nation state. And that is a modern concept. But very often, there are rulers who abuse the people's sovereignty, misappropriate it for their personal benefit, either material benefit like, you know, corruption and so on, or political benefit. And if you have repressive regimes, then there is a need to protect the people's sovereignty from the outside. Very often, if you have a repressive regime, that's the only remedy that is available. And that is the foundation for justifying intervention. And this has been developed, not just in the Warsaw Declaration, but there is a report, the responsibility to protect, that was submitted to Kofi Annan. And I think that is a very fruitful path. It has some really interesting applications, particularly when it comes to control over natural resources. And you may have heard of the attempt, the publish what you pay initiative. I think that holds great promise, because the natural resources belong to the people. But the rulers can use it for their own benefit, and then they have a source of power. They have an inducement to remain in power, and you find that countries rich in natural resources are actually poorer than other countries, and also more repressive generally. So by making the companies that make contracts disclose their contracts and what they pay, you can hold the countries responsible how they use the money. And that is a very fruitful area of this the people's sovereignty. And then from there you have to go on what constitutes a legitimate international institution that can that has the responsibility to protect. First and foremost would be the United Nations, but it can't deal with everything because it's an association of states. So therefore you come to this community of democracies, and I think that there are other sources of legitimacy than the United Nations that can be used. However, the Bush Doctrine is not a sufficient basis of legitimacy, as we are now discovering in Iraq, because we have conquered Iraq. We came as liberators, I'm talking now of America, but we are seen as occupiers. And the only way in which we can now gain some legitimacy for arranging for a transition is to bring in the United Nations.
Some of us, George, like to recall that the British people beheaded their king 150 years ahead of the French, but never mind.
Wasn't modern enough.
NTC, government department. You mentioned the importance of the lack of criticism in increasing the bubble of American supremacy. Evidently, in democracies, the media play a quintessential role as a critical voice. To what extent do you think the structure of media ownership in the U.S., in which a handful of largely deregulated companies control nearly all major media outlets, plays a role in the bubble? And if indeed the structure is an issue, how do you reconcile the need for regulation with the capitalist principle of laissez-faire?
Yes, I think that the ownership structure does have a negative effect. And the recent proposals to allow further concentration is really going in the wrong direction. But I think the trouble actually goes much deeper, and it's something that preoccupies me, because you really now have a situation where there is a what I would call an Orwellian truth machine in operation. A truth machine that manufactures truth. And you could see it in operation in the Iraq war. If you compare the coverage on Fox News and Sky News, Sky News gave a much more balanced view than Fox, because it was catering to different audience. So there is, particularly in the United States, but it's not only there, something going really quite wrong as far as the availability of information. And that's, to me, a surprise, because my foundations have been engaged in trying to foster pluralistic and professional media standards of journalism in the former communist countries, and to then see the deterioration of standards in the United States, not to mention Britain, I find very disturbing.
Thank you. Next one in the middle there at the back. Thank you. Yeah.
Shara Ali, currently a European candidate for the Green Party, amongst other things. I wanted to address this to a point made by Mary Calder, if I may. I'm no Blairite, and much as I remain unconvinced by Hutton's findings, I wanted to know whether you would have been equally critical of him had he vindicated the BBC and condemned the government. And if not, doesn't it sound a little bit like sour grapes after the fact?
Brief.
Yeah. No doubt I wouldn't have been equally critical of him had he done exactly what you asked. But I still would have had the problem, which I've had. I would have been very surprised if he'd done that, because given his terms of reference, he was very unlikely to do that. So no doubt I would have been less critical of him. But I think the point remains that, given the conclusions that he did come to, it leaves a lot of people feeling very dissatisfied. It leaves a lot of people feeling that actually we haven't dealt with the fundamental underlying issues which people are deeply concerned about. He's left them aside. And I think we would have felt less dissatisfied had he come to a different position. But I still think there would have been a need to ask for a broader public inquiry.
I think that the fact that Hutton was defined so narrowly really, in a way, opens up the larger question. You know, how come that the intelligence reported, you know, weapons ready for use in 45 minutes when they don't exist?
Well, I'm always finding surprising political groupings in the school, but the Greens for Blair is a new one, so front row here.
Mr. Soros, as a fellow American, you may also understand the difficulty of conveying to the American electorate the responsibility that we have as such an important effector of world policy in electing our president. How do you plan to convey that message to the American people, that is, to take responsibility for foreign policy through our election of the next president, as opposed to domestic issues, which seem to be looming large as the election approaches?
I think it's a very good question, because the election campaign is not a good environment in which to discuss these sort of broader issues. So I hope to generate some discussion. I intend to visit the campuses in America and start the discussion to the extent I can.
We're running slightly short of time, but I'll take three or four more questions. I think we can run over a few minutes. One straight there. Thank you.
Michael Smith for A Change magazine. I'm wondering, Dr. Soros, what is your recipe for the Western powers to really establish a basis of trust with the whole sort of Arab Muslim world? I mean, is it settlement in Palestine, or what is it?
I think it's going to be a long, long, hard road, and you can't expect immediate. But actually, open society, truly open society, where you empower and encourage people in the region to form their own views rather than to impose our values on them. In other words, I don't believe in public diplomacy promoting the American cause, because it's not approved in those countries. However, I think that there is a window of opportunity in the Arab world. In Egypt, Saeed Ibrahim was released from jail. With the Court of Cassation making a very broad judgment that, in fact, it is all right for civil society to function and to accept support from abroad. So that's just one opening. In some of the Gulf states, Al Jazeera, we in America condemn it because we feel that it's anti-American. But actually, it is having a very positive effect on Arab, developing an Arab public opinion. So helping Arab political development in various countries, I think it's a long road, and it's not in itself a way of dealing with terrorism. But I think it will bring some results.
Thank you. Now, there was one. You had a hand up a long time ago in the middle there. Yes, thank you. Man in the sort of decorated pullover, you might say, behind the woman with the black hat.
I can't see the hat, unfortunately. At times are inevitable. Do you see any possibility of developments in international law which would make this possible under the umbrella of the United States, of the United Nations? And if not, where does this leave the United Nations?
Well, I think that there is room for developing more robust ways of dealing with repressive regimes, including perhaps even military intervention.
Thank you. Now, we are running over time, and other people have things to go to. I had one more right on the back row up there, yes, and I'm afraid I think we'll make this the last one, if that's...
My name is Nei Ong. MSc student in financial economics. You mentioned that sanctions are not particularly helpful. I'm wondering what should be the U.S. role in dealing with a country like Burma, and when do you think will be a constructive engagement in that country?
Burma.
That's right.
Well, the Open Society Institute, my foundation, has a Burma project because that's a clear case. It's one of the most repressive regimes in the world, sort of ranking right up there with North Korea. And the only lifeline is external pressure. I must say that I'm very frustrated that this pressure has to be take the form of isolating Burma. But there is no, at the moment, no other alternative. So I think one has to persist, and the regime actually is crumbling. And if there is any chance of more constructive intervention, I for one would certainly jump at it. But that would mean the junta engaging in some dialogue with Aung San Suu Kyi.
George said he will take a couple more, I think mainly because he spotted there are quite a few American voters out there. So we'll take one on the front row here.
Another American. Given that there sort of is a bubble of American supremacy underway, and that Bush has really protected himself through low interest rates from Greenspan and tax cuts from the Congress, couldn't the bubble be pricked by the dollar collapsing before the election? I think Americans would have a very difficult time voting him in if the euro was at $3, you know, 3 euros.
Well, should the stock market collapse, I will surely be held responsible.
but basically,
you know, Karl Rove is in charge of the economy, of the global economy, and he's done an extremely good job in pumping it up for the elections. I was worried that perhaps too much has been thrown at it, and because of that, maybe interest rates would start rising, and that would then bring about the reversal before the elections. But that seems to have faded. So I think they have it made, more or less. It's what I would call a jobless but profitful recovery that has been engineered. And I think it's been very successful, and the price will be paid afterwards in 2005 and thereafter.
Thank you. Now, this really will be the last one. Madhabat, thank you.
Arade, my name is Mohammed. From a Muslim point of view, it's very encouraging to see such a view be expressed, you know, similar to the, what's happening in the Middle East. My question is, what activities being done on the roots, what causes terrorism? Because what I see is the approach taken is very, it's a big mistake. And what I see is that the main point is not being addressed, which is what causes terrorism. And, you know, if that is eradicated, then Bush has no platform to perform.
Well, look, terrorism is a very serious threat. And some of the measures that were taken are absolutely necessary, and more additional measures. I think declaring war on terrorism and giving it a literal meaning of military action is the wrong way to go about it, because terrorists are invisible, and therefore they don't have an address. When you wage war, you need to be able to know where the enemy lies. And if you don't see it, you can't hit it. And if you insist on hitting it, then you hit innocent civilians. And of course, it is in the nature of war that innocent civilians are killed. But that sets in motion a kind of vicious circle, because innocent civilians dying then creates resistance and resentment on which terrorism flourishes. So we were perfectly justified, in my opinion, in invading Afghanistan, because that's where bin Laden lived. We knew that was his address, and the Taliban was fully responsible for his being there and was supporting him. So the Afghan invasion was fully justified. The Iraqi invasion could not be justified on the same grounds. And waging war on terrorism has already claimed more innocent civilian lives than the terrorist attack of September 11. This is something that goes without being noticed in the United States, because those people whom we kill are not Americans on the whole. But nevertheless, the people there have a different view. And that is how the way we responded to September 11 has generated a great deal of resentment and animosity towards the United States, whereas in order to deal with terrorism, you need terrorists. You need to be able to locate them. It requires intelligence. It requires the cooperation of people. They have to be on our side. And that's where we lost them. We had the sympathy of the world on September 11, and we have lost it through the policies we have pursued.
Well, thank you, Mohammed. I think that was a very good question on which to end. I'd just like to say how grateful we are to Mary for commenting on the book, and for George for choosing to come and launch it here. He has been too polite and reticent to point out that it is here and it is on sale. And the American edition is $22, but if you want to buy it in this country, you have to use hard currency, and it's $12.99.
And I hope all proceeds will go towards the defeat of Bush.
It is an interesting read. I mean, particularly the second half, which maybe we haven't done sufficient justice to in the discussion about the different mechanisms and the different structures of international collaboration that could be put in place. I found that particularly stimulating read. So thank you all for coming. Thank you for your questions.